Right now, it is time to bring in David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning, every Friday morning, or just about 99.9% of the time. David is a PBS television correspondent working on ethics and belief with his reports. He also has his own website, which is themediabeat.us, and he keeps us informed about really what's going on, not only with a view of a reporter that's been reporting on topics like this over the years, but someone who also has really great ties and strong ties with Europe, so we can get a better idea what the overall look of the world is. David, nice to have you on the air again this morning.
Well, yes, I'm glad to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and talking once more, of course, with the sagacious Marshall Miles. Well, what can I say, Marshall, this week, coverage, well, there's been interesting news overnight, of course. The first time in three decades that the U.S. Congress has come out with gun legislation, a bipartisan bill actually passed in the Senate late last night, 65 votes to 33. For some kind of gun control. Not an awful lot, it has to be said. The bill is being described as a compromise by your own senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, who led the negotiations between both sides. But it is bipartisan, which is quite something. That 65 vote is considerable. It means that 15 Republicans voted for it. But at the same time, the news yesterday was that almost a contradictory kind of development in that the Supreme Court struck down legislation in my home state, New York, about carrying of weapons out in the public sphere, which could be a precedent for other states around the country, making it overall easier to get a gun and carry it around in public. So I trust that the media will help us thrash out these two contrary developments and help us understand how things might go from now on. But I guess there's some element of progress in that, even though there's a, what many would see as a step backwards at the same time from the Supreme Court, the judgment, in fact, being written in this case by the arch-conservative Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Bench. But it has to be said that coverage of the January 6th hearings is certainly hotting up. I mean, I think you'd agree it's been quite a week. Huh?
Well, what's interesting, I want to just touch on the Supreme Court decision for a second, is when I consider the Republican Party and conservatives that it used to be, conservatives wanted less government in your lives and less intrusion by the government into your lives. And this ruling by the Supreme Court, once again, is the Supreme Court moving into take control over a state issue, what the state has decided. And that surprises me on that count, and no other count than that once again, those, if you're a true conservative, you don't want the federal government interfering in what you do in your home state. But you're right that the January 6th commission, I really didn't know what to expect. But this past week has led to things that will bring in new witnesses in the coming weeks, and there's no smoking gun yet, but there is some smoke emanating from somewhere, because there's some shocking revelations here by shocking people.
Sure, and sure, media management terms that we need to talk about. The The Democrat-led House Committee's strategy seems to be working pretty well in incremental terms, though. As you say, there's nothing dramatic and explosive there, but evidence is piling up in the way that they clearly have been wanting it to pile up, chapter by chapter. I mean, the aim is to tell the American public, or at least try to get through to it, the story in their terms of Donald Trump's guilt in the matter of the attack on the U.S. Capitol. And committee members have been steadily building up more and more testimony from, and this is quite deliberate, of course, from Trump's own advisors and his fellow Republicans and even his own family. And they've shown, and they keep on showing, how Trump's efforts are deliberate and pre-planned, and extending from the Trump White House via his own direct or his delegated pressures on states that are reporting election results he didn't like Georgia and Arizona, Pennsylvania. On his own appointed Justice Department officials, that was especially evident yesterday, and on his own Vice President Mike Pence, who had that formal role to play in certifying the overall national election result. But yesterday's session, as I say, focused on those Justice Department officials, with three of them giving formal testimony in public. It gave us, I think you'd agree, a gripping narrative in particular of an Oval Office meeting with those Justice Department staff. In particular, the acting Attorney General at the time, Jeffrey Rosen, who'd taken over from Bill Barr. One of the extraordinary things about that Oval Office meeting was that Trump was trying to elevate this interesting character who's come to the fore, the toadying justice staffer, Jeffrey Clark. The idea was to elevate him to take over from one of the three who gave evidence, the acting Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, and replace him. Now, Clark himself was not giving evidence, of course. The last thing we heard of him yesterday was that he was reportedly in the street in his pajamas after his suburban home was raided by federal agents and his electronic devices seized. He himself has been declining to answer the committee's questions, of course, on the classic grounds that he might incriminate himself. As I think about it, I want to withdraw the adjective toadying in relation to Mr. Clark. On reflection, I feel it's unfair to the innocent. That innocent creature, the toad, is what I mean. But let me say that, in media terms again, perhaps the most striking development for media people on this story is the hitherto little-known role of another documentary filmmaker, another British documentary filmmaker, no less, not unlike Nick Questa, do you remember, who was spotlighted in the very first public hearing of the committee with his coverage of the alleged conspiracy's boots on the ground, the so-called Proud Boys, who were so preeminent in the insurgency into the Capitol building. Now, the newly spotlighted filmmaker is Alex Holder, another Brit, and he was being interviewed yesterday, though, away from the spotlight. He was just giving it's very important. I mean, but it was private. He was giving a deposition to the investigators, and only that for now, at least. But we will hear more, I'm sure. Well, we could all know that. And of course, he was being interviewed about his footage of the alleged conspiracy's high command, not the boots on the ground, the commander in chief, in fact, Trump himself. And his immediate family. The whole focus of his project is on Trump and his three adult children. There's 11 hours of his footage, and it's being subpoenaed by the committee. And there's a reason for that. I think Holder's own approach is one that I understand. The subpoena is definitely necessary, like many a journalist. Myself included, Holder has clearly not been eager to rush forward to help officialdom. It's not our role as journalists. Our journalistic ethics hold us to different behavior. Really, we're not part of the prosecutorial process, and shouldn't be in terms of our own deliberate efforts. We can be compelled, of course, when necessary, and that's what's happening now. And what's also happening, of course, is that some clips of the material are coming out. Although he's got a contractual relationship, Alex Holder, with Discovery Plus, the streaming channel, who are going to be showing the complete series of three programs later in the summer, Holder has been allowing some clips out as he can under a fair use agreement, as I think it's called, for CNN and both CBS News to carry those clips. They're really compelling, what's coming out. And there is more to look forward to. Can I just make a personal reflection here? It's not dissimilar. I was in a position of having filmed the activities of the modern-day Ku Klux Klan in western Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana over a summer a good few years ago now. But I was asked to help the FBI in its continuing work to monitor far-right organizations like the Ku Klux Klan. And I was happy to be interviewed in their Western Field office and over in Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. But I did say that if they wanted to see my footage, the unused material, in addition to the broadcast documentary, which of course is already in the public domain, they would have to apply for a subpoena, which they did. Myself and CBS News, who I was working for at the time, let them have the video. Now, that's a somewhat parallel situation. I think that's good ethical behavior by the journalist involved, and Alex Holder is sticking by that kind of approach. And it's going to be interesting to see what the committee does make of that footage. And by the way, there's another documentary maker also called Alex, but it's a female Alex in this case, Alex Lee Moyer, who was on the ground with another set of people that day, and her footage is likely to be brought into consideration. Whether or not it's going to be subpoenaed is an open question still, though.
You know, interesting. What I think the committee's doing, and I think that they knew that this was going to happen, with Jeffrey Clark, the Department of Justice, once again, the feds raided his house looking for material. I think that where he won't answer questions to the committee, when he sits in front of the FBI or those agencies, he's got a clear decision to make whether to really make things look bad by, you know, saying he doesn't want to incriminate himself, or else he's really going to have to testify. It's not the same as being called by the committee when you're sitting face to face with FBI or federal agents.
Yes, refusing to answer FBI questions is somewhat tantamount to impeding a federal officer in the pursuit of its. Of the federal officer's duty, and that in itself is an offense. Yes, I think we have more to look forward to in terms of what's going to come out on the Jeffrey Clark story. It's also compelling, as Capitol Hill drama, that it's easy to forget that there's a whole other world out there of news. But I would like to move on to Europe, if I may. As you know, and one of the reasons that, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, that I appear with you 99% of the time. Well, sometimes I'm traveling and can't make our regular Friday morning date. But one of the reasons for that recently is I just spent 2 months or so in Europe. I was in France and Ireland mostly, although I did drop in on Britain too. This weekend, Europe is coming to the fore a bit. I mean, the White House press corps are going over there with Joe Biden. There are two summits, the G7 nations meeting in Germany and the NATO alliance meeting in Spain. I want to highlight one aspect of European coverage that came to the fore while I was there. I've been reflecting on it all together now, while the French media, who I was consuming their work for quite some time, they're still reeling from the 1-2 punch of the elections. First, a gratifyingly decisive presidential election, and then a somewhat contradictory parliamentary elections that went somewhere rather the other way for President Macron. He's now got a very solid opposition to him from the left in France's parliament. But I'll leave the French alone for now with their own domestic concerns, in the full knowledge that they will be very soon criticizing their newly divorced partner, Britain. That divorce is still at the heart of all the discontent that flows back and forth between the now no longer European country, Britain, and the rest of Europe. And that leaves the Irish, who I got a lot more close to because I was there much longer, than their media, their coverage of the post-Brexit scene is well worth highlighting. And I'd like to toot our horn, as we say around here, blow our fanfare for the Irish media. Let's hear the fanfare for them if we can. Yeah, the fanfare is for the Irish media. They're always forthright, the Irish media. But interestingly, in this case, in this post-Brexit situation that I'm having to report on, and giving that Ireland has undoubtedly some skin in the game of the post-Brexit scene, they're actually being quite coolly analytical and thorough and serious-minded in their coverage of Brexit's consequences. They've managed to avoid the hysteria of their opposite numbers across the sea in Ireland, in England rather. In England, it's all loud partisanship in the media, pro and anti Boris Johnson, and that partisanship still reigns supreme. But with the Irish, it's different, and it's concentrated on factual reporting, I'm glad to say. Bear with me a bit, because there's some detail to keep a hold of here. That Irish skin in the game I mentioned is considerable. The divorce agreement that the Johnson administration in England negotiated in detail with the EU, and then Johnson himself signed in a very public ceremony, included what has been blandly named simply the Northern Ireland Protocol. This protocol was designed to ensure that the border between UK-controlled Northern Ireland, of course, and the Republic of Ireland to the south, would remain that completely porous and peaceable border that it's now been for 30 years now, or getting on for 30 years, thanks largely to the peace agreement of 1998 that ended 30 years of bloody warfare in the north. And during the negotiations for that divorce agreement between Britain and Europe, no person of goodwill, at least, ever wanted to see the creation of a so-called hard border again that could resurrect the old enmities. Nobody wanted a return to the days of violence and killing, of course. Now, after the agreement's been signed and agreed and put into practice, the Brits have now published a plan to, in essence, tear that divorce agreement up, the agreement they once accepted, and they're going to replace the protocol with something designed to placate Northern Ireland's angry unionists or so-called loyalists. The hardliners in that camp have been viewing the protocol as a barrier erected between them and their mother country of Britain. Now, in the south, the Irish press has accurately reported the actual effect of Johnson's new moves to be, and I'm going to quote them now, a new low in Irish-British relations. This is serious diplomatic stuff. The Republic's Taoiseach, that's the Prime Minister, Micheál Martin, was quoted as saying that the British have committed what he called a fundamental breach of trust and would create very difficult times ahead. And it's worth saying also, Marshall, that the United States has skin in this game too. After all, the U.S. nominated chair of the Marathon talks that created that peace agreement two decades ago was that greatly patient senator, George Mitchell from Maine. He helped bring around he was fundamental to bringing into being the peace agreement that has held so successfully all these years. Now, the United States is also a legal guarantor of that crucial agreement. And now, not only has the Biden administration been telling London it regards the protocol's survival as vital to that peace agreement staying in place, but as the Irish Independent newspaper has been telling us, Johnson's foreign secretary, Liz Truss, it's a difficult name to get a hold of, but she's the foreign secretary. She was sent a really stiff letter by the U.S. congressman, Bill Keating, who's the foreign affairs chair, and Brendan Boyle, the House European Affairs chair. Together, they're both insisting to Ms. Truss that Britain should not be acting unilaterally, as they're trying to now, but instead it must, and I'm going to quote them here, that Britain should act in good faith within the parameters of international law. This would be the way, they say, to avoid the worst outcome from Brexit, which they fear would be, and again I'm going to quote them directly, the congressman, the worst outcome would be violence and upheaval again in the north of Ireland. The question that journalists all want answered, of course, is will Truss's boss, Boris, be responsible and pay attention to all this global rollout of objections to his plan? Well, your guess is as good as mine, Marshall, and your guess is probably the same as mine.
You know, what's interesting is on top of that, you have, what complicates this even more attention-wise is that with the latest vote, what happened, Boris Johnson, once again, who has more lives than cats, 9 lives. But that's another thing that takes attention away from this. And the problem, nobody wants to see what happened years ago happen again. And yet there's so many things on Boris Johnson's plates, and you just don't know what's going to happen. It's a very explosive situation.
Yeah, the vote that you mentioned is the latest blow to Boris Johnson. It's local elections in Britain are clearly showing that his popularity has slumped a lot more dramatically than I think people wholly or a lot of. The partisan reporting ever allowed us to see until now. But sure, when the voters get a chance, as they have done in these local situations, they've expressed it very firmly. And Boris Johnson is yet again reeling from another blow. But as you say, he's got many lives, like a cat. How he's going to respond to this is an open question. And one of the problems, of course, and this will not sound very strange, I mean, it will sound rather familiar to many American listeners, but we have there in place still a leader who is renowned for his sheer recklessness. He's certainly been reckless about the Northern Ireland situation. While the negotiations were going on, it was as if he didn't care what might happen in Northern Ireland. And now he's paying the price for that politically, and that's led to his trying to change the agreement, tear up the Northern Ireland Protocol, and get back in the good books of his so-called loyalist allies. Loyalty seems to be a one-way street when it comes to Boris Johnson. And the recklessness might take us in all sorts of unwelcome directions. We can but hope.
You know, you're right about that, because the people negotiating with Boris Johnson, how can you have faith? He is all over the place, like you say, reckless. How can you have faith in those negotiations?
Well, yes. The divorce agreement, as I keep calling it, yeah. It's the handiest way of describing it, has been in place now for 18 months. And if you sign an international agreement and then within 18 months you say you want to tear it up again, then it's hardly surprising that the French in particular, but Europe as a whole, in the form of the EU and its institutions, are scratching their heads now and you know, certainly not very sympathetic to the British view that they want to renegotiate the whole thing. They agreed, and you know, the details were signed on the dotted line, and now Britain's trying to do the very opposite of what they agreed to do 18 months ago. As you say, it's a hard situation in which to negotiate anything fresh.
You know, and I compare that, and you can compare and contrast. The United States for 4 years under Donald Trump assumed one position. Joe Biden is in now and assuming a different position. And I'll just put it this way: Europe and the other European countries look at us now and say, What do we have to look forward to? Will Joe Biden be replaced by Donald Trump again in 3 years? It's the same thing. You lose a matter of stability and trust when you have such wild swings.
Of course. As international diplomacy is all about trying to preserve some kind of equilibrium. That's what is lacking whenever these allies sit down now. They have made a great point of saying how glad they are, our Western allies, to be sitting down with Joe Biden and saying what a wonderful breath of fresh air it is, and the sense of America is back is the phrase. Yes, they can't help but look askance and say, well, it's okay having Joe Biden with us now. For now, he might be out of office again. He's very likely to be out of office again within 2 years. And what do we have then? I wouldn't like to be in their shoes, sitting at a table with that future in front of them, nagging at the back of their minds as they consult with their fellows over this weekend of summits.
David, it's always great to talk with you. It's such an explosive time around the globe. We didn't even have to even look at the Ukraine. There's just so many other big stories that are affecting the world as a whole. And of course, you can find out more at David's website, which is themediabeat.us. David, we'll speak to you again next week.
Look forward to that.
The Media Beat with David Tarachuk. Once again, his website is themediabeat.us.